Welcome, this is James Corbett from CorbettReport.com, and it's the 6th of December 2011, and today we're talking to Robert DeFord about Mae Brussell, a researcher who lived in California and was researching the JFK assassination, most notably for many years, but of course many other subjects besides. And although she passed away in 1988, her legacy lives on at maybrussell.com. So Robert, it's great to have you on the program today. Thanks so much for taking the time to talk with us.
Oh, it's my pleasure, James. Thank you for your work and your effort to bring Mae alive again.
Well, absolutely. And it's such an important thing to do because for listeners who haven't encountered Mae Brussell before, she was just an absolute fount of knowledge on so many different subjects. And of course, as I say, most notably, she's known for her work on the JFK assassination. But of course, that work branched out into so many different topics. If you were going to introduce Mae Brussell to listeners out there and the incredible scope of her work, what would you talk about in terms of the types of subjects that she was interested in?
Well, you're right. I think the JFK assassination was definitely the fire that ignited Mae Brussell, and she spent countless hours before she went public with the Warren Commission report, which is several volumes, quite a few. It's like a Britannica, Encyclopedia Britannica set of books, and she cross-referenced it in minutiae to try to understand as much as she could. And she was a very brilliant person as well, so she had the brain power. But the deeper she got into the Warren Commission report and the deeper she did cross-research with a lot of these names that were coming forward in the volumes of testimony and so forth, the more she examined that information, and the more she became persuaded and convinced of a conspiracy that was quite deep and wide. And towards the end of her life, she finally wrote an overview of it that you can find at maybrussell.com, which is the Nazi connection to the JFK assassination. And it's a must-read for a broad overview and very, very specific details of how the conspiracy worked, how it was able to be pretty invisible, and how all these poor figures like Oswald and many others, David Ferry and others, were puppets, if you will, in a grand scheme, an amazingly sophisticated conspiracy of like-minded people to get rid of Kennedy so they could have that war in Vietnam. And Kennedy was about to take apart the CIA and expose a lot of that information that's still deeply and darkly shrouded in their ancient history, so to speak, of the CIA's origins. So working with Mae was always an inspiration. She was so thoroughly informed. She subscribed to many daily newspapers and magazines, and she would get phone calls in the middle of the night. People who trusted her would share with her knowledge, information, and tips. So her life was a total 100%, well, I shouldn't say 100%, because she had a personal life that was quite colorful and interesting. She had several kids, children, offspring that she, of course, mothered, but also that she kept in a normal world. I mean, she, of course, shared with them her beliefs, but she also was quite good at knitting and sewing and cooking and just the mundane things that any family appreciates. So she had that side of her, too. She was obsessed with finding the truth about politics and so forth, but she also lived a very common, ordinary life as a mother and friend to a lot of people.
Well, certainly she must have been quite a multifaceted woman. And just even you talking about her work, one of the things that really strikes me about it is that as overwhelming and as impressive as her research is, it's that much more impressive to think that she was doing all of this well before the internet, well before computers, that she was just working from paper files and subscribing to newspapers and clipping them out. I mean, just a mind-boggling amount of work must have gone into her research. But before we get too much into that, perhaps we should start but setting the background for the listeners to tell them a little bit about your own encounter with May and how you came to know her.
Well, James, that's a firecracker of a question, because when I lived in Big Sur, I worked for a man at the Big Sur Inn called, his name was Helmut Dietjen, D-E-E-T-J-E-N. He was from Norway. He was a mystic person who had a very, very, very unusual life himself. He was, and I don't know if your audience appreciates too much of this metaphysical stuff or mystic stuff, but he was born in Norway in 1892 and in a very wealthy home in Bergen, Norway. And as an infant, he was having visions of the future, and conversations with God, as he put it to me. I was a 21-year-old dropout art student when I met him in 1962. So he introduced me to metaphysics and to politics, and sort of the esoteric side of both politics and what we call religion. The kind of occult side, if you will, the hidden side of both. So anyway, in his infancy, he was seeing the future. He was seeing World War I that was coming, World War II that was coming to the planet. And it was really, really hard for him to relate to his brothers and sisters or his parents. And they were troubled. And they took him to a doctor, well, several doctors in Europe and then in Sweden, to a phrenologist. A phrenologist is someone who claims they can read your skull, so to speak. They place your hands on the skull, and your skull has bumps and grooves like canyons and mountains. And apparently a good phrenologist can kind of read a person's skull, like a palmist supposedly can read a map of you in the palm of your hand and so forth. Well, anyway, by the time I met Dietjen, he had built in Big Sur, California, the Big Sur Inn. He was a builder. And so he started telling me little by little, he was a man of few words, but he told me little by little things that had happened to him in his life. And at the end of World War I, he left his home in Norway and he walked across Europe. And in Munich, in about 1919 or 1920, he met Hitler, he met Oswald Spengler, Rudolf Steiner. Perhaps your listeners haven't heard of Spengler, maybe they have. Steiner, he was a Christian mystic in Germany, in Munich at the time. So Dietjen met these people. At that time, Hitler was pretty much not a politician, per se. I mean, it was before he became a politician. He was more a mystic, truth-seeker yogi, actually. He was what we would call a bhakti yogi, a yoga of devotion. And he was also Dietjen and shared with me that he was what we would call a medium, like a trance medium, which may account for his oratorical powers, that he had the whole nation, half the world, pretty much hypnotized by his oratory and this extraordinary aura of I don't know. anyway, So Deachin started sensitizing me to some subject matter that I'd never even considered or thought of. And it started me researching on some of the subjects, like Hitler, for example. I became fascinated by the phenomenon of Hitler and the war, of course. And then towards the end of the war, all the unanswered questions about all the Nazis that escaped and how come we inherited all the exotic weapons of Nazi Germany, the rockets, the mind control experiments that they were doing in the concentration camps. They had hundreds of thousands of guinea pigs, human beings that they were experimenting with and upon at the and they were, of course, at the mercy of the Nazi establishment. So they had acquired quite a bit of what we consider, we being the American government, considered invaluable. So we, in my opinion, cut a deal with Hitler towards the end of the war, and we inherited tons of exotic materials, weapons, scientists, blueprints, patents, rockets, and even a disc-shaped aircraft that we now call UFOs. That came over with this largesse of weapons and scientific research and development that we inherited. And in return, in my opinion, and a few other people, there's a good book out about all this called The Nazi International by Joseph Farrell, an excellent book. And then Mars, what's his first name? Jim Mars?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he wrote a book recently on the very same subject of the Nazi International. It's kind of invisible right now, but it's strictly multinational corporations all tied together and in an umbrella over this entire planet, if you will. But anyway, my research, Deachin didn't tell me any of this stuff. I just independently found evidence of, and with May's work, we found evidence of all kinds of agreements that were made, that are most of which are still top secret, I would say. The agreement that Hitler struck a deal with, say, Alan Dulles, is still secret, and the CIA gets started. They shut the doors of the OSS at the end of the war, James Donovan's intelligence agency that was quite fruitful throughout World War II. They closed it down so that they could start up a different system, a different intelligence agency, more under the control of people like Alan Dulles and others. And the grandfather, if you will, of the CIA, one of the fathers of it, was a guy named Reinhard Gehlen, who was the chief intelligence officer for Hitler on the Eastern Front throughout the Soviet Union. He had hundreds, maybe thousands of agents buried down deep into the Soviet system. So that kind of resource, there were people in this country, mostly I would call them the fascist estate, that were loyal to the political system called fascism, which is simply, in my opinion, corporatism on steroids, so to speak. But the fascist contingency, people like Prescott Bush and others, Lindbergh, Henry Ford, Alan Dulles, who I consider a fascist sympathizer, certainly, and a lot of others, decided they wanted their own intelligence apparatus, so they brought in Gehlen, Hitler's guy, and brought him in illegally in the back door, and they put together the CIA, and then a little bit later, Gehlen was released to go back to Germany, where he became the head of Germany's equivalent to our CIA. So anyway, May had done a truly amazing amount of research on all this, and she did have a photographic memory, and she did have a system. It's interesting you brought that up, James, about the internet, because she was like a precursor to the internet. She had her own filing system, color-coded, and over 30 filing cabinets, not to mention her book library, that she could, in a matter of a few seconds, find exactly the document that she wanted to find because of her own system, her own archival system that she developed on her own over the years, and it was very unique. I can't fully explain it, but to say that it was, like I say, color-coded and then had a lot of other features that allowed her to immediately or very, very quickly find exactly what she needed when someone had a question or another researcher wanted to know, where'd you find this, man? So she she had that pretty wired. And like I say, lots of daily newspapers and magazines and people would call her because they trusted her. So that's a little bit about me and about why I connected with her so deeply, like a bunch of us have or did. We just trusted her and had a high respect for her and her dedication, that anyone who's curious about the dark politics of the United States and the world will find her just a constant fountain of insights and knowledge and the ability to connect these otherwise what look like loose ends. They might look like dangling cables in a telephone company that's been exploded, but she could pull them together. And unfortunately, the other researchers in the Kennedy assassination investigations were mostly men, and they didn't really respect May enough. They wouldn't include her in a lot of the get-togethers with these guys and their conventions and all this stuff. So she was really fighting an uphill battle with fellow researchers, because she was way ahead of them and fought on much larger scale. And a lot of the other researchers were really not genuine researchers. They were oftentimes spooks and people that were just trying to create scenarios and detours to the true conspiracy behind the death of Kennedy and Bobby Kennedy and Martin Luther King and a long list of others, including John Lennon. And May's work touched on all the other prominent assassinations and victims of this web of conspiracy.
Well, as you point out, obviously your research and hers meshed quite closely on the issue of the Nazis and how they really did not go away in 1945, which is something that I think is starting to become more commonly known, but still I think no one really got into it quite as much as she did and explored all of those connections. So she's probably best known for her radio program between 1971 and the time of her death in 1988. But what time period did you start to get to know her and start working with her?
Probably around 82, 81, maybe 82, in that neighborhood. So for the last years, 7 years maybe of her life, I don't remember exactly when I started, but we helped her transition from a radio station in Carmel to one in Pacific Grove, where she continued her work on a weekly basis with a two-hour program, 1 hour being her explaining with her. She'd have a sheet of paper of single-space typed paper on both sides, sometimes two sheets, outlining that week's hour-long program, and then another hour would be spent on the telephones, on the telephone answering questions people would call in. So that was at another station, KAZU in Pacific Grove, and that's where she broadcasted from until she got too sick and then died very quickly after that. But yeah, roughly, James, roughly 81 or 2, something like that.
Interesting. Well, tell us about what it was like working with her and what kind of research that you guys did together.
When we got on the subject of Fritz Kramer, I went up to the Hoover Institute at Stanford University, which is an archive of original documents of the Nazi government, to try to find information about Fritz Kramer, because May was persuaded, and I tended to agree with her, that the Fritz Kramer that's Henry Kissinger's mentor was in fact the very same Fritz Kramer that was found guilty at the Dachau military tribunal that was investigating the massacre of U.S. prisoners of war at Malmedy in Belgium by the SS. I forget the number of U.S. Army personnel that were murdered with machine guns and on tanks by Piper. Piper was the tank commander, and Dietrich, one of Hitler's favorites, was part of it. And a guy named Fritz Kramer carried the orders from Hitler to the front there in at the Battle of the Bulge and towards the end of World War II. And it was a very bitter winter throughout that war, throughout that battle. And there was over, I think, 100 U.S. Prisoners of war that were murdered, mowed down by, like I say, by the machine guns, and a couple of them survived. So after the war, there was a tribunal and a trial to determine the guilt of each of the individuals, to what degree of guilt. Well, a fellow named Fritz Kramer was a subordinate to Piper and Dietrich, and he simply carried the orders from Hitler's headquarters to the front. So he was found guilty in sort of a minor way and sentenced to 7 years in prison, where Dietrich or Piper and some of the others were found guilty and were given the death sentence. Well, after the war, you had a whole whitewashing of people like Joseph McCarthy came along and others who started beating the drums to get the Germans freed from these sentences. And it worked. The media helped quite a bit. The Congress got persuaded, and John McCone was a high commissioner in Germany. He released Piper. He released and others that were sentenced to death, but their death sentence hadn't been carried out yet. But they got all released. Kramer rather disappears, and then there's a Fritz Kramer that shows up in the Pentagon during the war in Vietnam. And then, like I say, in these books about Henry Kissinger, in most of the books that talk about Henry's life, they talk about this German fellow named Fritz Kramer who Kissinger called his mentor. He was also a mentor to James Schlesinger, hard to say, James Schlesinger and others in the Pentagon. He was I'm going to have Tim Canale send you, James, this essay about Fritz Kramer that showed up in the Los Angeles Times by Nick Femish, journalist who studied Kissinger's Kramer. So there's the Kissinger's Kramer, Fritz Kramer, and then there's Hitler's Fritz Kramer. And so May believed, and I agreed, that it looked like they were the same person. So I went to Stanford Hoover Institute Library to try to find more about Fritz Kramer. So I asked for his box, and they went down into downstairs into their archives, and they came up with a box with Fritz Kramer's name on it, but it was empty. So someone had emptied the box. So there was very little documentation about Fritz Kramer. We found some, and then there's a couple books, A Crossroads of Death, a book about that massacre at Malmedy, and a book about the trial called Crossroads of Death that talks a fair amount about Hitler's Kramer. So I did quite a bit of research on that subject, and May was doing her own research, and Leon Panetta at that time was our congressional representative from Monterey to Washington, and of course later he became more prominent, and now he's I think head of the Defense Department, was head of the CIA under Obama. So Leon Panetta found us a photograph of Fritz Kramer, of the Washington, D.C. Fritz Kramer, the Pentagon Fritz Kramer, and we had some old pictures of Fritz Kramer, Hitler's Kramer, and it looked like the same guy maybe 20 years later. But there was no way we could come up with a way of actually finally proving that theory. We did everything we could to get as close as we could to the truth of that interesting hypothesis or theory that Kissinger's Kramer is the same as Hitler's Kramer. But we couldn't quite, I would say, get 100% closure. So, but that's one area that I was totally fascinated with and spent a lot of time and hours trying to uncover as much as I could about the Kramer mystery, the Pentagon.
Fascinating and frustrating that there is no closure to something like that, but it is an interesting piece of a puzzle which obviously adds up to something more, and I think something that May must have been, from what I can see, obviously I never met her, but from what I can see from her work, must have been very good at putting those puzzle pieces together and connecting the bigger picture.
Yep. She was a total genius, and unfortunately, being female, she was not included in the club of men researchers on the Kennedy assassination. She was always an outsider, always out trying to share her vision with other researchers. And mostly they would try to ignore her or dismiss her, or, oh, May, the Nazis. And just kind of try to drum her out of their little club. So that was a frustration for her, and I'm sure it hurt her feelings quite a bit because of the amount of commitment she had to that investigation. And there were a few investigators and other researchers that really loved her and appreciated her and hung with her, so to speak, or were on her side, but the voice of her voice was really not fully heard, although there were a couple of radio stations that would take her tapes each week and play them, so her voice got spread a little bit, but not nearly like some of the celebrities in the Kennedy assassination community, the researchers. But be that as it may, people like you, James, who are reviving her, so that we can all look again or listen to her or reconsider her views, especially with some of the books that are coming out now, and Operation Paperclip and The Secret Agenda by I forget the lady's name that wrote it, but it's an excellent book about the illegal, treasonous acts of the U.S., of a part of the United States government when they brought in the Nazi war criminals and rocket scientists. And James Loftus, or John Loftus, his books on the same subject are excellent. Joseph Farrell's written 3 books recently on the subject of the Nazi exotic technologies that we inherited, and the Nazi International, which is now a super corporate, massive corporate entity that was started by Hitler. Hitler was pretty sure he was going to lose the war in 1943, so he instructed Martin Bormann, his number two guy, to set up over 700 dummy corporations all over the world. And there's a good book on that subject, Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile. You can find it for free on the internet. Manning is the author's name, M-A-N-N-I-N-G, his last name. And the book titled, like I say, Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile, you can find for free at Animal Farm. It's a website on the internet. It's the most important book to bridge that mystery between the end of the war and the beginning of the Cold War and the invisibility of the Nazi Empire that went underground after the war and went corporate. So, so today we're starting to get that kind of information again. I mean, on a more contemporary view, a more immediate look. Like I say, with Joseph Farrell and Jim Mars. So, May was a prophet in a sense. She plowed the ground. She was the pioneer to go deeper and wider than any person I've ever met. And she had a big heart. She wasn't just a cold, calculating, analytical person. She had a big heart. She was a great Jewish mother. Made good chicken soup. But anyway.
Well, it is so great to hear that as well. But you were mentioning before we started recording this conversation that there were a number of people that had kind of gathered around her as her kind of research assistants in various ways. Tell me a little bit about that.
Dave Emery has carried on May's work in a truly significant way. He has a radio program once a week. And there again, you can go to his archives on the internet and listen to hundreds of hours of analysis. And he had a brain, he has a brain much like May's, very, very brilliant, radio voice, good sense of humor sometimes. And his work, in my opinion, is close to May's. And carried it on, took the tendrils of it, the roots of it, and carried it on and updated a lot of her material, and has kept that fire burning more than anyone I know, that I can think of. There were others. John Judge worked closely with May. He inherited her entire library after she passed away, and we loaded everything up from her house, all these filing cabinets and her entire library, and took it to Santa Cruz, California, where John Judge hoped to put together a museum or a resource center of May's work. Well, unfortunately, that didn't work out. There was some internal conflicts between Dave Emery and John Judge, sort of like a family feud. So that project didn't get off the ground, so we had to take all that material down to Santa Barbara and try again in another facility under another organization, and that didn't go very far. And then all that material went to another person, I forget her name, Virginia. Tim Canale knows her a lot better than I do, but she inherited everything again. And now apparently she's looking for some place to have it finally put put to rest, or let's say finally put into the hands of someone who can make it available to people. And maybe it would be valuable or useful information for people who are dedicated to this kind of research. A lot of it would be outdated, but a lot of it would not be, because she kept such a careful filing of every single newspaper article, every single magazine, every book, everything she could get her hands on were archived and organized, highly organized. So that's another big question. What will happen to her largesse, her life's work? It's as far as I know, it's languishing in someone's basement up in the Bay Area, San Francisco Bay Area. And maybe someday there'll be a sugar daddy come along and say, "Hey, I'll take care of all this for you guys." And maybe it'll be well preserved and staffed by a few people and made available again. She's got all the radio shows, which Tim Canale has generously put into DVDs, so people can order her entire, almost all of her between 700 and 800 hours of radio programming. He published on a DVD. You can see it at MaeBrussel.com. You can order very inexpensively, along with the video he did of Mae Brussel. The only video documentary we have of her was a lecture she gave at UC Santa Cruz, and we were able to get our hands on that hour-long, grainy, kind of a Mickey Mouse camera that happened to be there that night and catch her. And Tim was able to make a beautiful documentary out of using that footage, but also integrating a lot of documentary footage that he found about the subject matter that she would mention. So he would cut into the film of, say, Dulles, Alan Dulles, or Kissinger, or Hitler, or World War II. He would integrate footage, a few seconds, of these various subjects that she would bring forward in that lecture at UC Santa Cruz. So that's a very, very valuable insight into Mae Brussel that Tim created. He's a documentarian and archivist for Mae Brussel's work. And his website's a fabulous resource. I'll say it again, MaeBrussel.com, pretty simple. Place to go and visit and see the stuff she wrote and people who have written about her. And she worked very deeply with Jim Garrison on his investigation in New Orleans of Clay Shaw and the conspiracy that was hatched in Texas and New Orleans to assassinate Kennedy. And you probably saw, your listeners and you no doubt have seen the movie JFK, an excellent attempt to awaken that interest in that terrible subject. So Mae Brussel, her website that Tim has created, has very voluminous amount of information and material and people that loved her and wrote about her, and plus all the radio shows. He didn't get all of them. He's missing maybe a dozen out of her, whatever, was it 20 years, James, that she did radio?
Yeah, I believe going on 20 years anyway, something like 17 years. Yeah. 1971 to 1988.
Oh, yeah, right. Yeah, well, thank you for your interest in her and your own interest. I don't know you very well. I just met you, but I'll hang out on your website. And,
well, I do appreciate that, but certainly I think some of my research interests co-align with Mae Brussels, although of course I wouldn't compare my work to hers in any way. Her research is really exemplary. And as you mentioned, people can go to maybrussels.com to order. There's a 6-DVD set with all 700 hours of radio recordings, and also you can get there's a 9/11 television coverage DVD that you can get with that as well. And I personally did order that, and I'm just starting to sort of dip into the archive. I mean, it's such an overwhelming amount of material that it's difficult to even know how to really approach it. But certainly, I wouldn't be recommending it to people if I didn't buy it myself, and I certainly just did. So, but on that note, I mean, we can access and we can have some sort of access to her work through the obviously her radio archives and all of that voluminous material that thankfully has been recorded for the ages and is now being distributed through maybrussels.com. Although it's painful to think of her entire archive just sitting in a basement somewhere. It's absolutely horrid to think of, and I certainly hope that doesn't end up in the wrong hands of someone who's not going to be interested in preserving and maintaining that information. I hope someone can do something useful with that. But of course, we can access the work to a certain extent in that degree, but we'll obviously never be able to access Mae herself. Are there any stories that you have that summarize Mae's character, or who Mae was as a person?
Well, there's one kind of interesting story about Mae and her work with Larry Flint, the publisher of Hustler. She worked closely with Larry because Larry was determined to get he was very, very concerned about the Kennedy assassination. He tried everything he knew how to do to expose the conspiracy behind it in a lot of his Hustler magazines, and he was making quite a loud noise and attracting a lot of good attention to a lot of the subjects that Mae was covering. So they got together and collaborated, and Larry Flint published a magazine called The Rebel. And Mae had the inaugural issue. She was chosen by Larry to write for the maiden issue of The Rebel. It was a short-lived magazine that unfortunately died a very quick death, so to speak. I think it maybe was 7 or 8 issues only. It came out once a month, I think. But the first issue, she set herself down for the first time to write in length her view of the Kennedy assassination, the overview. She always wanted to write a book and never quite had the time, but when she was asked by Larry to write something for the magazine, it's when she wrote the Nazi connection to the JFK assassination, which you can find at maybrussels.com. The magazine itself is rare because it didn't last very long. It was a beautiful effort on Flint's part to write, to do nothing but write newsworthy information. It was not a smut magazine, had no beautiful women undressed or anything like that at all. It was purely on par with, say, Time magazine without the ads. It was strictly his attempt to get out pure information about the various conspiracies, and, mainly, though, the Kennedy assassination. And what you may already know is that Larry Flint was shot, and that's why he's in a wheelchair today. It was an effort to assassinate him when he got so vocal about the Kennedy assassination. And so he was crippled by a bullet in his spine. So, but he's carried on as best he can over the years, with in serious pain and on lots of drugs. And Mae tried to warn him that some of the people who he was inviting to his house were intelligence people, and that they were not his shouldn't be considered his friends, and he wouldn't listen to her all the time. So, because a part of the time, I think he was sort of doped up with painkillers and whatever. But unfortunately, their relationship kind of petered out, and the magazine didn't really fly very far, very fast. And it, after I think 6 or 7 issues, went bye-bye. So that is one story I like to tell, because generally speaking, Larry Flint's not known for his serious investigations or research, but he has a serious side, and he tried his best to do his best to get that information out to the public, to make a mark, and did everything she could do, and she did write. Finally, it caused her to write the best thing she had written on the subject and the most lengthy essay on the Kennedy assassination. Otherwise, you'd have to listen to 700 or 800 hours of Mae Brussels to glean her thoughts on and her research on the Kennedy assassination.
Well, that is an interesting story, and I myself just encountered, I never heard of The Rebel before, but I just encountered it recently on the MaeBrussels.com, and I find that interesting. I think there must be an extremely interesting story to tell about Larry Flint's life, given the types of things that he has been involved in and exposed so many different things through his magazines. It's quite amazing, and I don't mean that in a double entendre way. I mean some of the political issues that he's done. Very interesting indeed. Well, Robert DeFord, we could talk, I'm sure, for hours and hours about Mae Brussels and the incredible work that she's done, but I just certainly hope that people will go to MaeBrussels.com in order to find out more about her and start to explore some of her writings and some of her thoughts. But I suppose on that note, I think we'll leave it there for now. But I just want to thank you very much for coming on and sharing some of your thoughts about Mae tonight.
You're welcome, and thank you for your work on her behalf, and for no doubt a lot of other researchers who are trying to give voice to this pretty nasty, dark stuff that we're all facing, and it's getting worse. So God bless you.